Well, I've always felt that it's far more important to set your sights high, you know, aim for something high, and even fail on it if necessary. To me, that's always been more impressive than someone who doesn't ask for very much and achieves it. I mean, there's not a great deal of satisfaction in that, in my view.
No one set his sights higher than Sir Edmund Hillary did, certainly not in the literal sense. Sir Edmund and his climbing partner, Tenzing Norgay, were the first people, of course, to set foot on the summit of Mount Everest. That was in 1953. Hillary, who died in 2008, is still a legend, though in life he was a modest guy, a former beekeeper who loved to walk. When he began his 1991 interview with the Academy of Achievement, he asked to be called simply Ed.
Well, I think the press and the public have created an image of Ed Hillary, hero and explorer, which simply doesn't exist. They've painted a picture of me, you know, as a heroic type, full of enormous courage, tremendous strength, undying enthusiasm and all the rest of it. Well, it's all really just, it's just a story, really, that's been written up in the newspapers. I'm a person, as I've said, of modest abilities, with a good deal of determination, and I do quite a lot of planning ahead. And with careful planning and good motivation, I think you can often achieve things that other much more talented people would probably do much more easily. But then a lot of these very talented people are not strongly motivated to carry out the things, perhaps, as I've been involved in.
We've got Sir Edmund Hillary and the world's greatest living mountaineer, Reinhold Messner, on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, perseverance, and scaling the peaks from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
I want to flag here again that coming up, we're going to spend some time with Reinhold Messner, the first person to climb every 8,000-plus meter mountain in the world, all 14 of them, and all of them without supplemental oxygen. He was also the first person to reach the summit of Everest solo, something he could have only done standing on the shoulders of Edmund Hillary.
Possible or impossible? That's the question. Possible or impossible? And each young generation tried to make possible what the old generation defined impossible. And this is part of my motivation.
We'll get back to Messner, who, by the way, became a member of the Academy of Achievement in 1987. But we need to dive in with Edmund Hillary's story first. He and Tenzing Norgay first participated in an Academy of Achievement summit in 1973. Hillary sat to do an interview for the archive in 91 and talked about everything from his early life in New Zealand to his work helping build hospitals and schools for the Sherpa people of Nepal. Hillary was born the year his father returned home from serving at Gallipoli in World War I. The family settled in a little town near Auckland named Tokau.
I suppose in many ways I was a fairly, not perhaps lonely, but I didn't really have many friends and so on. And I used to go on long walks. I was a very keen walker. And as I walked along the roads and tracks around this countryside area, I'd be dreaming, my mind would be miles away, and I would be slashing villains with swords and capturing beautiful maidens and doing all sorts of sort of heroic things just purely in my dreams.
He was a great reader, adventure books mostly. As a teenager, he had to travel by train 2 hours to high school and 2 hours back. He read almost a book a day during those years, incubating dreams of the adventures that lay ahead. At first, he was the smallest and youngest kid at school, and still quite lonely. But then he sprouted 11 inches in 2 years and got a lot stronger, which helped.
When I really sort of started getting going, you might say, was when I was 16 years old. And I was at high school, and I went with a school party about 250 miles south of Auckland, where I lived, down to our national park area where there are a number of big volcanic mountains, and there's lots of snow there, and this was the middle of winter. And there was snow everywhere. It was a really good heavy snow year. This was the first time I'd ever seen snow, because we don't get it in Auckland. And for 10 days I skied and scrambled around the hills. And for me, it was the most wonderful experience I'd ever had up to that stage. And I think it really was the beginning of my enthusiasm for mountains and for snow and ice. In fact, it was really the first real adventure I'd had, whereas before I just read about it and talked about it. And I think as a consequence, it built up, even at that early stage, a very strong affection for mountaineering. I knew I could do it and enjoy it. And so, you know, it grew on me. And of course, after that, I did a great deal more.
His family was fine with his newfound hobby, and they liked listening to the stories he'd come back with. He had a few friends, too, who were interested in tramping and trekking around with him on their local hills. But it quickly became obvious that Ed Hillary was a stronger walker and more energetic than they were. He was the one clambering up trees to figure out where they were. He made his first major climb in 1939 when he was 20 years old, reaching the summit of Mount Olivier. But still, at that point in life, he couldn't have guessed how important mountain climbing would become to him.
I really had no idea whatsoever. I mean, I feel that, that my life really sort of developed as I went along. I was never one of those people who at an early age had picked an objective and worked steadily towards it. All I knew is that I wanted to do things that were exciting and adventurous.
He became a navigator for the Royal New Zealand Air Force during World War II, and he joined his father and brother after the war, tending their 1,600 beehives. But happily, he says, his parents didn't put pressure on him to stay in either of the family businesses, beekeeping or journalism.
My father took over a newspaper in a small country town, and it had the grand name of the Tuakau District News. And it was very small, but he did everything. You know, he did. He was a reporter. He went to all the football matches and reported on them. He knew everybody in the whole area. And then he would write the articles. He would set up the actual type, as you used to have to do in those days. And then we had a printing press in a shed on our small farm, and he'd print the newspaper. In fact, I think the only thing he didn't do was actually deliver it round to all the houses in the area. So he, in his own way, was, I think, a very resourceful individual. But my parents also were people of very strong character. They had strong principles, as many people did in those days. And it was during the early days of the Depression. I know my father felt very strongly indeed, feelings that the, you know, there was a period when food was being destroyed in order to keep the price of food up. And yet there were thousands, millions of people, you know, going short on food. And that type of thing really irritated him. He thought that was completely unjust. So I was rather, although I was not aware of it at the time, I think I was brought up to this feeling that it was important to be interested in the welfare of other people and other people around the world, really. My mother always used to say to me a thing which really, when I look back on it, wasn't terribly logical. When I was had a large meal put in front of me, and even I, and I had a pretty hearty appetite, couldn't quite get through it, she would say, Edmund, remember the starving millions in Asia. Now, what possible use my consuming it would do to the starving millions in Asia, I don't really know. But the fact remains that I was brought up to think about the starving millions in Asia. So that meant I had to clean my plate up and not leave anything and waste it. Later on, I got more involved with the starving millions in Asia, but perhaps in a slightly more practical way, in helping some of them with schooling and hospitaling and even in agriculture.
According to Edmund Hillary, there was nothing extraordinary about him. And that, in many ways, is the part of his tale that's most inspiring to the rest of us.
Oh, I'm definitely, I have very modest abilities. Academically, I was very modest, mediocre, perhaps. And I think, perhaps physically, I was never what you would call a great athlete, in the sense that a great athlete has a tremendous eye and tremendous ball sense and, you know, great speed of movement and all that sort of thing. I was more the perhaps slightly rugged, robust sort of type. I was physically strong, I think, but I think maybe the only thing in which I was less than modest was, I think, in motivation, maybe. I really wanted very strongly to do many of these things. And even I think in those early days, if I started out to do something, I generally ended up by getting pretty close to completing it. I think motivation is the single most important factor in any sort of success. Physical fitness is important, technical skill is important, maybe even the desire for money for is important in some respects. But sort of basic motivation, the desire to succeed, the desire to stretch yourself to the utmost, makes the difference between someone who does really well and someone who doesn't.
So at what point did he become successful enough at exploration that he began to think of it as a career option? Never.
Well, I still regard adventure pretty much as a hobby, to tell you the honest truth. And I think this approach to it keeps one refreshed almost. I think if you just regard adventure as a business, well, it can become very boring, as many other businesses can become. But even though adventure changed my life considerably, both in what I was doing and even economically, I guess, I've always regarded myself in a sense as a competent amateur. And because of that, I think there's been a freshness has been brought to it, that every new adventure has been a new experience and great fun. I really like to enjoy my adventures. You know, I get frightened to death on many, many occasions. But of course, fear can be also a stimulating factor. When you're afraid, you know, the blood surges in the veins and so on. If you get rigid with fear, quite obviously, fear is not a very satisfactory characteristic to have. But if it's a stimulating factor, then I think you can often extend yourself far more than you really believed was possible. And instead of being, you know, just a mediocre sort of person, for a moment anyway, you become someone of considerable competence.
Fear and mediocrity. Sir Edmund circled back to them as forces for good a number of times in this interview.
I know that in many ways I'm basically a very mediocre person. But I also know that if your abilities are fairly modest, there are ways in which you can use them effectively. I think, for instance, that prior planning, slowly and carefully working out how you're going to meet problems if they arise, Now, I always have in my expeditions people who are academically far cleverer than I am, and even technically far more competent. So if you want to lead an expedition, in a sense, you've got to keep ahead of them, these very bright, competent characters you have with you, who are marvellous to have on the expedition. And I've always found you can do that by each night when you go to bed, you just let your mind dwell on the likely things that may happen next day, and think out carefully the sort of decisions that may be necessary to make in order to have the program carried through. So next day, something happens, you're the one that's thought about it, and you're the one that has the ideas, whereas all the brighter ones really haven't spent too much time thinking about it.
Sir Edmund believed that most people, if they really want, can learn to be good leaders, even if it doesn't come naturally to them. And he put himself in that camp. He learned by practice and took inspiration from an earlier adventurer.
I did have definitely one heroic figure who impressed me very much indeed. And that was the great Antarctic explorer, Shackleton. Shackleton I always admired because he was Shackleton was a tough man and he was a very good leader. And whenever he was in difficult circumstances, which he frequently was, he seemed to have the great ability to inspire his men and lead his party safely out of those conditions. Shackleton was a man who was prepared to make a decision and change his mind quickly. Now, there are, you know, a lot of very successful explorers who choose their plan and their path and stick to it very closely indeed, following it very methodically through. Now, this was not the attitude of Shackleton, and certainly wasn't my attitude. I was the sort of Antarctic explorer. If someone came up with a good idea, I was perfectly prepared to accept it and use it, and usually they were pretty good ideas. And I was always prepared to, if the circumstances seemed suitable, change a complete plan to go in a different direction or use a different method. We achieved the final objectives just the same, perhaps, as many other expeditions, but maybe we had more fun in the process because if there seemed something we could vary and do that was interesting, well, we did it. So certainly Shackleton, I would have said, more than anything, was a role model for me.
Sir Edmund Hillary never had a vision to climb Mount Everest, but for several years he gained more and more experience as a climber and an expeditionary leader in the Alps and in the Himalayas. It was only then that he read in a newspaper that the British had gotten permission to do a reconnaissance expedition to the south side of Mount Everest, through Nepal, which had until then been completely closed to foreigners. He joined that team of climbers, and the next year was invited back for more exploratory climbs. Finally, he and Tenzing Norgay were invited to attempt the summit of Mount Everest, and on that note, I think it's about time we begin the ascent, one step at a time.
I never climbed up anything one step at a time. You know, you read so much about at extreme altitudes, how you take one step and then you stop and pant and puff for a while and you take one more step. I don't ever remember doing that. I mean, you're much slower at high altitude because of the lack of oxygen. But I used to keep moving pretty steadily most of the time. And I didn't have to stop too often for panting and puffing. I think I was pretty well adapted and acclimatized to altitude. And I think I was very fit in those days, so could keep moving very freely.
What went through his mind as he got higher and higher and slower on Everest or any other high peak for that matter?
My mind concentrates pretty much and rather firmly on the job in hand. Certainly on Everest, for instance, where we were using oxygen, I was constantly doing mental arithmetic, checking the pressure of the oxygen bottles, and I had to convert that pressure over to the number of litres of oxygen that remained in the bottle, and then work out how many hours or minutes of activity we still had left. So constantly we were dealing with the problems of the slopes and the soft snow and everything else and crevasses that we had to deal with. Certainly in those days, I think a lot of the modern mountaineers with their very good technical equipment and their very accomplished techniques can climb perhaps more naturally and easily than we did in our day. But of course we had one problem that the modern mountaineer doesn't have, and that is this psychological barrier. We really didn't know whether it was humanly possible to reach the top of Mount Everest. And even using oxygen, as we were, if we did get to the top, we weren't at all sure whether we wouldn't drop dead or something of that nature. All the physiologists had warned us that the altitude of the summit of Everest was a very marginal altitude and might be extremely dangerous. So one had this feeling in your mind all the time. Maybe you were just pushing things a bit beyond what humans were meant to do. And you couldn't ignore that feeling. But because of strong motivation, you keep plugging on and you seem to be going okay. Nothing seems to be going wrong. So you persist. And we persisted, of course, and ultimately set foot on the summit.
When you heard Hillary just say, nothing seems to be going wrong, so you persist, he didn't actually mean nothing. He meant something more like nothing you might not anticipate as an incurable mountain climber on a mission with pretty low odds of survival.
Well, there were lots of challenges. You know, even the route we were climbing Mount Everest was one of the two easiest routes on the mountain, as we know now. Of course, nobody had climbed it then. But even so, there are demanding parts of it. At the bottom of the mountain, there is the ice fall, where it's a great tumbled ruin of ice that's all pouring down and filled with crevasses and ice walls. It's under slow but constant movement. So it's a dangerous place because things are always tumbling down. So you have to establish a route up through that, which you can get with reasonable safety. But over the years, literally dozens of people have died in the crevasse. They've been engulfed by ice walls falling down and things of that nature. I had one experience on the ice fall with Tenzing. We were actually descending after having been further up the mountain. And it was getting close towards dark, so we wanted to get through the ice fall before darkness fell. And we roped together, but I was rushing down ahead in the lead. And about halfway down, there was a narrow crevasse. I guess it was about 4 feet wide, but just a bit too wide to step across. But on the lower lip was a great chunk of ice stuck against the ice wall. And we'd used that as sort of a stepping stone to get over the gap. Well, I came rushing down the hill, and without thinking too carefully, I just leapt in the air and landed on the chunk of ice, whereupon the chunk of ice broke off and dropped into the crevasse with me on top of it. And it was interesting how everything seemed to start going slowly, even though I was free-falling into the crevasse. My mind, obviously, was working very quickly indeed. And the great chunk of ice started tipping over. And I realized if I wasn't careful, I'd be crushed between the ice and the wall of the crevasse. So I just sort of bent my knees and leapt in the air. But I was still falling, but now I was a couple of feet clear of the chunk of ice. Well, you know, time really seemed to pass, even though I was falling clear. And I realized that unless the rope came tight fairly soon, you know, I would come to a rather sticky end on the bottom of the crevasse. And up top, Tenzing had acted very quickly. He thrust his ice axe into the snow, whipped the rope around it, and the rope came tight with a twang, and I was stopped and swung in against the ice wall. And the great chunk of ice just carried on and smashed to smithereens at the bottom of the crevasse. Well, then really it was just what I would have called a routine mountaineering matter. I had my ice axe and I had my crampons on my feet. So I chipped steps in the side. I was able to bridge the crevasse and I worked my way up to the top and got safely out. Now, I wouldn't have said at any stage, because it all happened so quickly, fear really didn't have much opportunity to emerge. My only idea was to get safely out of this unfortunate predicament. And of course, without Tenzing's very competent mountaineer's response, I certainly wouldn't have made it. But once he had stopped me, then I was able to, using the techniques of mountaineering, get myself safely to the top again. But those sort of things, you know, when you've been going as long as I have, many of them have happened during the course of your life. But you tend to forget them, really. It's the good moments you, I think nature tricks us a little bit, because you tend to remember the good moments rather than the uncomfortable ones. And so when you leave the mountain, you remember the great moments on the mountain, and as soon as you leave the mountain, you want to go back again.
If you're anything like me right now, you're probably thinking, really? You forget the near-death experiences? The sensation of plunging down an icy crevasse? I don't know about you, but nature never tricks me that way. And perhaps that is what separates the Edmund Hillarys of the world from the rest of us. The interviewer wondered whether Hillary at any point felt that he and Norgay might not make it and might have to give up.
Oh, I would put it in quite a different fashion and say at never at any stage until we actually got up the rock step was I confident that we were going to be successful. My feeling was that we would give it everything we had, but we had no surety that we were going to reach the top. In fact, I believe that if someone starts out on a challenging activity, completely confident that they're going to succeed, why bother starting? I mean, it's not much of a challenge. I think it's much better to start out on something that you're not at all sure that you can get up. And then if you do overcome it and you do manage to defeat the obstacles, then the satisfaction is so much greater.
If you picture Ed Hillary and Tenzing Norgay going a little wild when they reached the top of the world, think again.
Now, I would have said there wasn't too much excitement as far as I was concerned. It was more a feeling of quiet satisfaction and almost a little bit of surprise. You know, so many really tough expeditions had tried the mountain before and not been successful. And here Tenzing and I were standing on the summit. You know, it almost seemed remarkable that we were there where others had failed before. But I think certainly on Everest, where due to the lack of oxygen, life is a somewhat lower level, as it were, I certainly did not have that tremendous feeling, you know, not wanting to jump around with joy or anything of that nature. I was just very happy to be there and felt very satisfied that we'd finally succeeded in getting there. Tenzing buried a little bit of chocolate and some sweets in the snow, which are really a gesture to the gods, which the Sherpas believe flit around Everest on odd occasions. I think I kept my more exciting moments for when we finally got down to the bottom of the mountain again.
At base camp, there was a little radio, and somebody turned it to the BBC in London to listen to the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. Right in the middle, the announcer broke in.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. Mount Everest has been conquered by members of the British expedition.
And then almost for the first time, I felt, my God, we've climbed the thing, you know. We've had authoritative support from the BBC in London. We've done it.
Sir Edmund Hillary was a New Zealander, but of course New Zealand is still part of the Commonwealth. So his achievement was a point of British pride and considered a good omen, actually a great omen, for the new queen. The Daily Mail headline read, "The Crowning Glory, Everest Conquered. Edmund Hillary plants the Queen's flag on top of the world." The New York Times said, "Two of British team conquer Everest. Queen gets news as coronation gift." By the time they got back to Kathmandu, Hillary had already been appointed Knight Commander of the Order of the British Empire, hence Sir Edmund Hillary. Tenzing Norgay, as a Nepalese citizen, wasn't eligible, but he was awarded the George Medal, given for acts of great bravery. In the years that followed, Sir Edmund climbed many other peaks in the Himalayas, and he ventured to the South Pole. He even went with astronaut Neil Armstrong in a twin-engine ski plane to land at the North Pole. But mostly, Hillary dedicated himself to helping the Sherpa people of Nepal build hospitals and schools. And he found happiness in family life, he said in this 1991 interview, until a terrible, terrible personal tragedy.
Well, I would have said in the first 33 years of my life, which is up until I climbed Everest, I was a very restless and to some degree, perhaps a slightly unhappy sort of person. I really didn't have a great deal of social life. Perhaps I was, in some respects, something of a loner, as it were. But after Everest, I got married, and that certainly changed my life very considerably indeed. My wife was very long-suffering. She knew that there were certain things I wanted to do, and she was happy that that I should do them. She was prepared to put up with considerable periods of being alone with the kids. And she was marvelous. So it made it possible for me to do the things that I wanted to do as well. And when I was home, we had a very relaxed and pleasant family life. So I really feel that that over those years, from 1953 to 1975, were extremely happy years for me. I did many adventurous activities. I got deeply involved in these aid programs for the people of the Himalayas. I had a nice family. We took our families into the outdoors. We camped and we swam and we clambered around the hills. And for me, it was a very full and a very happy existence. Well, then, of course, came the disaster in 1975 when my wife and my youngest daughter were flying into the Nepal hills where I was building a hospital. And their plane crashed and they were killed. And this certainly, for me, was an absolute disaster, really, because two people who meant most to me, really, in life, had been killed in one fell swoop. I found the only way, actually, to deal with it was to carry on very energetically doing the things that we had all been doing together, which was largely building schools and things for the mountain people. And although people used to say to me, well, time is the great healer and all this sort of thing, certainly for the first few years, I simply didn't accept this. But time was a great healer. And after, the years passed, the memories certainly still remain. But I think quite a lot of the pain tends to fade a little bit. And as time passed, you know, life did become a little bit easier. And then, of course, some years later, my wife and I had been very close friends with another couple. Peter had gone with me to the South Pole and been with me in the Himalayas, and his wife June and my wife Louise were very close friends and had been for years and years. Well, Peter died in a plane crash, and this was a plane crash in the Antarctic. And so ultimately June and I, who had been close friends for years and years, decided, well, it wouldn't be a bad idea if we were both alone, so we got married. And so over the last 6 or 7 years, that has been a very happy arrangement and, in a sense, a new stage in my life has developed. I firmly believe that companionship and good companionship is one of the most valuable things that you can have. And we have certainly had that over the last 7 or 8 years.
When Sir Edmund Hillary had this conversation with the Academy of Achievement in 1991, he was in his 70s. He seemed genuinely content with his life and happy to have passed the baton to younger adventurers. Sir Edmund Hillary died in 2008 and was given a state funeral. His rugged, beaming face is pictured on New Zealand's $5 bill. Part two of this episode is about a man who grabbed the reins from Sir Edmund and took mountaineering in whole new directions. And I can think of no better pass-off than these final comments by Sir Edmund Hillary about where he saw the future of mountain climbing.
Most of the big mountains have been climbed. The summits have been reached. The poles have been reached. People have been down to the depths of the ocean. You know, all the grand things really probably have been largely done. So the really good explorer today gets his challenges by doing things in different ways. He perhaps will climb a mountain by a much more difficult route. He'll do a face climb, which may be steeper and more dangerous. So I think it's all relative. It's not really what you've done that's important, but it's the sort of challenge it has been.
Sir Edmund Hillary was exactly right. The generation of adventurers born after him, with nowhere higher to climb, found their own challenges and their own firsts. Reinhold Messner became the first person to climb Everest solo and the first to conquer all 14 of the world's 8,000ers, mountains over 8,000 meters tall. That's 26,000 feet. Messner is the most famous living mountaineer in the world. His name isn't as recognizable in the United States, but he's a huge celebrity in Europe. A couple of years ago, the British newspaper The Telegraph even called him the greatest living man. He's now 74 as I record this podcast, and he lives in the same mountains where he was born in northeast Italy, a mostly German-speaking province near the border with Austria. That's where Washington Post reporter Mary Jordan traveled in August of 2018 to interview him for the Academy of Achievement. They spoke in one of his 6 mountaineering museums, perched among the peaks. We'll get to those a little later.
Let's talk about 1980, when it was one of the greatest feats that anyone had done when you climbed Mount Everest solo. For people like me who can't even imagine climbing it, could you talk about how you prepare and then how you go up? Just bring us there. How much time, what preparation goes into before you begin this amazing feat?
I had preparation for at least 30 years. So my first steps I did as a 5-year-old boy in the Dolomites with my father and my mother and my older brother, climbing the first 3,000 meter peak, let's say 10,000 feet, a climbing mountain, but not a difficult one, an easy one, is the first step for the know-how I have today. I was only going in very small steps, every weekend a little bit more higher, a little bit more difficult. And up to the age of 22, 23, 24, with the clear view, I'm doing what the people of yesterday could not do. My capacity, my power, my agility, my knowledge was growing year by year, and I was doing always something more difficult. I tried to overcome the limit of yesterday, and next day again overcome the limit of my limit.
For Messner, climbing is a way to get back in touch with our essential human nature, when it's in danger, when it's lonely, when it's silent, when it has no sense of time. These parts of human experience, our genetic rule book, he calls it, are difficult to connect with in modern society. Messner sees himself as part of the alpinist tradition, going back 250 years, but he came to practice an extreme form of it, of rock climbing and mountaineering, that few before him would recognize.
When I was 16, my brother was 14, we were beginning to do extreme climbing, very young. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, we started at home. Our mother made us breakfast, and we put the rope and the pitons, and we went. And she never said, "Don't do it, this is dangerous." She knew exactly what we are doing.
Don't you think that's remarkable?
That's very remarkable, because she was full of fear. But she also knew that if we would not do it, if we would be forced to leave this enthusiasm for climbing, we could never become strong characters. This is not possible. You need the freedom to do what you like to do.
Messner calls it an egotistical pursuit, and his mother's fears were not ungrounded. In 1970, he and his brother Gunther, already two of the best climbers in Europe, joined an expedition to climb a mountain in Pakistan called Nanga Parbat. They made it to the summit. This is one of those 8,000-meter peaks. But they weren't able to begin their descent until the next morning. By then, Gunther was delirious. On the way back down, he was swept away by an avalanche. Reinhold was up ahead and survived, but he had frostbite and lost 6 toes. The tragedies didn't end Messner's career as a climber, hardly, but they did shift what he could do and what he wanted to do. He gave up extreme rock climbing and set his sights on other high-altitude climbs, something he could manage with few toes because of the thicker, harder shoes that you wear. But to up the game, he decided to see whether he could do what medical experts said was impossible, climbing at 26,000 feet without bottles of oxygen, and doing it alone.
It was the first time when I was forced, in this case I was forced, to begin a new life. And the problem was not a technical problem, not a logistical problem. It was a problem, a mental problem, to be able to handle, to be on the end of the world in very dangerous situations by yourself, not being able to speak with anybody, not being able to exchange experiences, not being able to divide fear. If you are together, fear is only half. If you are with one man, only half. If you are three, it's only a third.
It's an insight that bears repeating. If you share your fear with another person, you divide the fear in half. If you share it with three people, you only suffer a third.
When you're at the base of Mount Everest and you're beginning your first solo ascent, what's going through your mind?
When I was beginning the solo ascent of Mount Everest, it was after 2.5 months being there. Because I tried just a month after reaching the base camp, but it was monsoon time, so many snow was in the mountain. Very big danger for avalanches. So at 7,000 meters, I decided to go down. And I went further north, because there the monsoon could not reach the mountains. And I could still train and acclimatize. And when the monsoon stopped for a while, it was a monsoon break, I went back to the base camp. I was prepared mentally, I was prepared physically perfectly, and I started being able with my rucksack to be autark, self-sufficient, for more or less 10 days.
What was in your rucksack?
everything to survive. A cooker for melting snow, some food, but not many, a small tent, a matras, a meter of rope, 2 meters of rope.
Did you bring anything for good luck?
No. I'm not believing in these things. It's not helpful. The most important thing up there is that we are drinking. I was melting snow in the tent because we lose a lot of humidity, water. We are breathing like dogs up there, running dogs. We are hyperventilating. We have to do it because there's so much less oxygen. In reality, the pressure in the air is much less than at home. And on the Everest, this is the limit people can stay on. And I could not take oxygen bottles. I would never be able to carry them by myself. You have to know that in the 70s, the oxygen equipment for one man on Everest had a weight of 50 kilos. So they needed a lot of helpers to bring all this stuff up there. And the first expeditions when the British and Americans, also the Indians in the 50s, in the 60s, went to Mount Everest, they needed tons and tons of materials. If you go alone, you need only the minimum of necessity. But you have to learn to handle it.
When you're melting the snow to keep liquids in you and you keep going higher and higher, what's the thin air feel like?
The thin air makes, first of all, that we are becoming slower and slower. Higher we go, less pressure is in the air. So no more oxygen is coming to our energy in the blood. And the sugar in the blood is the energy. And we need oxygen to burn it, like to burn wood. If you go at 8,000 meters, you cannot make fire with wood. It's not possible. There's not any more burning. There's oxygen is missing. And if there is not enough oxygen for your energy, which you have in your circulation of blood, you are doing one step and you do a rest, another step and you do a long rest, another step and a longer rest again. So you're becoming infinite slowly. The second thing is also the brain is not anymore fully with oxygen.
Do you feel like you're hallucinating?
Now you're becoming less and less and less willpower. Also, your capacity to decide. The decisions are very important. What you do, go left, right, go down. This is getting...
But how do you overcome that?
You are like a zombie up there.
Like a zombie. You're in thin air. You're trying to make the right decision. What does it feel like when you get the last step to the top?
This is nothing special. This is... You do it in a very, very small steps, very small steps. On the near the summit of Everest, I do 1 or 2 steps, and afterwards I have to have a rest, otherwise I collapse. That's the difference.
And so at the summit, you do 1 or 2 steps, you sit.
Yeah. No, I don't sit. No.
What do you do?
We put the ice axe in front of us in the snow or in the ice, and we lean over to open the chest, that there is place for oxygen, for air.
And when you get to the highest point on Earth, what does it feel like?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Higher the mountain, less emotions. There is no place for emotions. There's only the decision, now finally I'm free to go down. Our strongest instinct, an egotistical instinct, is our instinct of survival. We have it. We are all egotistical. And human race is still alive because we are egotistical. Otherwise, I would do the first mistake and I would die up there. This instinct is keeping alive my body, my mind. But I go against my instinct higher and higher. My instinct is, in the last part, every step saying, let it go down. This is too dangerous. You go more and more in danger. And on the summit, we are far, far away, farthest away from safety. So there is only the necessity, an inner necessity, given us by this instinct of survival to go back. The big emotions are coming when you go back to life, to the first water running up. There is no running water.
What does that feel like when it comes back, the emotions?
You come back to life, to be alive up there. You are so exposed. You are on the limit of exposure to less oxygen. It's very cold. No water. You have to make water. There's no, ice, you can make water. Food is not so important. But coming back, you have the warmth of the sun. The sun is warm down there. Up there, the sun is not giving energy. You have people around you. You have birds around you. You have insects around you. You are in the middle of the life. And this is the strong moment. And this moment is like to be reborn. But in this case, not your mother gives you your life. You, by yourself, you conquered your life back. You went in a totally, in an area, in a world which is not made for human being. And you feel it every second. This is not made for us. But if you come back to the place which is made for human beings, you are reborn. And you have the totally life before you. And with all your fantasy and energy, you start the next project. For having again this feeling of being reborn.
They call Everest the highest graveyard because hundreds of people have died.
But on the Matterhorn died more people.
And you've done all of these over 8,000 meters, more than anyone on Earth. But so many people have died, and the chances of dying are high.
Yeah.
Why do you think you survived?
Because I was lucky, because I was...
But you said you didn't believe in luck.
No, it was also luck in sense of... if I would look to the most able alpinists, traditional alpinists, of the last 50 years, most of them I know personally, 50%, exactly 50%, died on the mountains and 50% survived. So this is the proof. This is not ability only. This is also luck. The avalanche didn't catch me on Nanga Parbat. I was a little bit ahead of my brother. But why? I was ahead because I was looking for the route. And he was waiting to get a sign from me that, okay, we can go further. So it happened.
You just said 50% of the people that were...
Died in the mountains, yeah. Of the absolute best people.
What made you, against those kind of odds, year after year, go back and go back?
I think that I have only one thing which many other climbers do not have. I had the opportunity between my fifth and my 15th year to learn naively to survive in the mountains. So it became an instinct.
An instinct that even the best rock climbers and mountaineers don't always have. But there's no denying luck or fate. At one point, scientists and mathematicians calculated that anyone who climbs 10 8,000-meter peaks has a 99% chance of dying. That makes Reinhold Messner one of the luckiest men out there.
But if somebody asked you, you're the most famous mountaineer in the world, why did you keep climbing?
Because it's absurd. It's absolute absurd.
It's absurd?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
You don't know, you know the word absurd? In
it's
English,
crazy?
English?
It's crazy?
No, absurd.
It's unlikely? No, it's impossible?
Absurd is a very important philosophical word. You know Camus?
Yes.
The French writer? He was writing a story about Sisyphus.
Yes.
The life of Sisyphus is typically an absurd life, the mythological life, naturally. But he's saying more or less, has no sense to go up and down a mountain, rolling up a stone, and the stone is rolling down, rolling it up again. But on the end, he's saying in his book, it's a small book, but we should imagine Sisyphus as a happy person.
The passage from Camus includes this line, "The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a man's heart." Messner did eventually stop taking his extreme excursions up extreme mountains. It wasn't that he was worried about pressing his luck. He just couldn't bear to hear another round of applause for him making another summit. He'd become too good at it, and that meant it was becoming too routine for a man like him. He needed something he wasn't sure he could handle. That led to a walk across the Gobi Desert and across Antarctica. It led to a hunt for Yeti, or a Yeti-like bear, which he says he found some evidence of. It led to a stint in the European Parliament. It led to dozens of books and some movies, too. And it led to him building a museum complex with 6 distinct outposts spread across the South Tyrol Mountains where he was born to honor the science and the history of mountains and the people who interact with them. His family told him it was a terrible idea. He might lose his money or his property. He consulted with museum directors. They told him it was nuts. 6 separate museums in such a small province. But for Reinhold Messner, the words, "you can't," are irresistible. He did. This interview with journalist Mary Jordan was recorded in a Messner Mountain Museum. Mary says it was stunning. Toward the end of their conversation, she noted that Messner looks a lot younger than his 74 years, given all the rough terrain he's traveled.
I think I look quite young because I have still a lot of hair, and because I have still the possibility and the energy to follow my dreams. It's a kitschy word, but in the meanwhile, I know that looking backwards to your successes is boring. Hopefully also in 5 years, hopefully also in 15 years, if I'm still alive. The art of living stays in realizing step by step, now and here, your dreams.
And not looking back.
And not looking back, because the happiness is coming out of doing it now and here.
In other words, there are more adventures, more risks ahead for Reinhold Messner. You can find out more about him and about Sir Edmund Hillary at achievement.org. And since we're heading into the holidays, if you're on the road looking for some inspiration, please check out all the other episodes of our podcast. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.